20 groups leaving an area all perform the same action, may we safely assume that the area from which they came was unaware of that action, in the sense of never having performed a similar action? May we assume that a certain pattern would proceed out of a center, but the center itself would be unaware of the pattern? Would it be possible that these migrants would have carried something with them that did not exist in the place they came from? And as all of these peoples did bring this, Planck is of the assumption that somewhere in the background of this great Indo-Aryan or Iranian-Aryan culture was the archetype of the great house of the mysteries. That this great house of the mysteries was not necessarily a temple, was not necessarily a great building. Perhaps it was the mysterious grotto ornamented with stars into which it is said the Zoroasters disappeared and remained in a kind of waitingness to return. Perhaps it was almost anything. Perhaps it was later symbolized by the great Institute of Meru in India. But whatever it was, Planck was convinced that it represented an assembly or an aggregate of enlightened and informed persons who at that time were responsible for the great pattern which was to arise in the religious and philosophic and even scientific worlds, inasmuch as the roots of all knowledge were in this core, even though the knowledge itself was as yet undeveloped by man. If Planck is correct, and he gives a great deal of supporting evidence that is rather difficult to refute, to say the least, then he takes the position that the great sages, the great scholars, and he wisely points out that these words that we use now have no real meaning in this pattern, that it represents a quality or a condition of enlightened beings totally different from our concept of the term enlightened beings, because we're using our own words for something else. But the best we can say is that there existed a core of knowers whose knowledge was real, whose knowledge was relatively, at least, absolute, whose knowledge exceeded that of any age that has followed them, and that the whole great search is the effort to recover it. Now, we might say that this is a very retrogressive look, that what we are actually looking for is a great and brilliant future and not an illustrious past. But Planck would cut through that entire point, and in his discussion of the matter of time, he brings out this very simple situation, that the individual who falls under the illusion of past, present, and future is defeated already. He will never find, because he is now applying time to a situation that is timeless, and that therefore nothing that is real is old or new. The fact that it existed 50,000 years ago does not make it old. The fact that it may be more completely realized 50,000 years from now does not mean that we will discover anything new. For that which is, like the eternal nature of being itself, is eternal. Therefore, we are quibbling when we talk about truth going out of fashion, or old-fashioned or new-fashioned truth. The only thing that can ever go out of fashion is untruth, and we're in trouble until it does. Consequently, what we are not searching for is a dead past. We're not searching for that at all, nor are we striving to bring a dead past to life. What we are searching for is that eternal truth that to our perceptive powers has been locked in a past, locked there as in a sarcophagus, buried there not by the gods but by man, and that it is the rolling away of the stone that lets out not an ancient truth or a new truth, but the truth. which is as new as now and as old as eternity. Consequently, what we are searching for is solution, not dating. We are searching for the eternal answer to the immediate problem, because the only answer to any problem is eternal. Any urgent answer, any compromise, any answer that is based merely upon passing situations can never be the answer to anything, because such false answers become themselves unanswerable questions in their own turn. So we have to search for this basic point. Pike then quotes from the Chaldean oracles of the Zoroasters to carry on his thinking. He is searching now for the father fountains of the ancient wisdom. He is perfectly willing to assume that this wisdom existed originally apart from man at all, but that apart from man, it has no meaning to man. A universal wisdom, completely independent of human need and human problem, becomes unintelligible to us. We can only affirm that it can exist. Therefore, wisdom, as far as man is concerned, is universal truth in that part of itself which is applicable to man, useful to man, necessary to man, assimilable by the faculties of man, and capable of being understood by man. Thus man is surrounded with absolute truth, but he can only nourish his own need on that part of truth which relates to his kind, to his species, to the situation unique to humanity itself. And under those conditions, out of an eternal reservoir of eternal fact, man has to draw that part which means the solution to himself. Thus the eternity of truth is not assailed, nor the divinity of it, nor that it rests forever in the divine mind and in the divine knowing. The primary purpose with consideration is that part of eternal truth which relates to man. Therefore, Pike now points out another issue of importance, namely that every one of the faiths that originated somewhere in this great complex of areas has as one of its essential principles the doctrine of mediation, the appearance of a link, an appearance of a prophet, an interpreter, one who receives the divine instruction and then communicates it. And that this divine teacher, in Pike's estimation, has two distinct meanings. Namely, the teacher always finally becomes identical with teaching. That we cannot actually identify a person apart from the thing he did, particularly in these matters. Because as far as the stream which moves through him is concerned, there is no clear identification. We are dealing now not with man as man, but as with man or a man as the symbol of mediation between eternity and time, between universals and particulars. And Pike points out the idea that teacher becomes the total of teaching, and that therefore at the root of every doctrine, every faith that arose in this region, is this first established point, namely the adaptation of universal knowledge to man through the arising of an instituted structure of teaching. And that this teaching takes out of space, as a prism, such forms of light as it can capture, and reflects these lights upon other things, in order that they may in turn be able to examine this light more completely and more intelligently. Pike therefore tells us in his belief that the great orders of mediators, or the great personal mediator between God and nature, is always symbolic of these ancient ones of the earth and of the institution which they created, by means of which they captured the fire of heaven and made it available to man. They did not capture the full flame. They did not take all the fires from the sky to light their altars. They lit their altars and the great fire remained. But the little fire upon their own altar was the symbol of a strange and mysterious comradeship, or a strange and mysterious relationship between the fire and the total flame, between the light and the total sun. Thus, ancient altar, in his estimation, was symbolic of the altar that was set up on the earth. The great focus by means of which knowledge in its true and proper nature came to man is the miniature of the great flame, that part of the eternal fire which he could use. But as Zeus, appearing to Semele, destroyed her in a catastrophe of flames, so that part of reality which is not applicable to man, beyond his power, beyond his need, still remains the great blazing totality in space. But man has taken from the total fire that warmth which is necessary for his own need. Thus, this ancient concept involves the principle that these ancient ones of the earth formed a kind of lodge, formed a kind of assembly, formed the equivalent of what the Kabbalists later called the sod, the assembly, the gathering of the great ones, and that these form the nucleus of the universal structure of truth, as this truth was applicable to men. And that it was not only the promise of these teachers that they would remain, or that they would continue to come forth, but that age after age they would be restored, and that they would continue this strange and mysterious procedure until truth was restored as the sovereignty over all that lives, that the war between light and darkness would ultimately end, that evil would be not destroyed but reconverted, brought back into humble identity with truth, that darkness and light would no longer be enemies, but that darkness would be the servant of light. And in another strange way, as Pike points out, light must in the end trust itself to the infinite benevolence of darkness. That these things are not friends and enemies anymore, but that when truth comes, the war in heaven and the war on earth both come to an end, and the golden age is restored. What then happened to the ancient body, this mysterious structure? Plato, I think, gives us a clue to this in the story of the lost Atlantis. For in a strange way, the Atlantic Empire was a symbol of something. The great king of Atlantis, according to Plato, was Atlas, who has later become known as the man who carries the heavens on his shoulders. In other words, the ancient thing, the old world, disappearing in the waters of time and illusion, the submerged continent that went to sleep in the deep. This strange submergence is actually a kind of deluge in which truth was drowned with error. Yet truth, lying beneath the surface of error, becomes the very foundation of restoration. Though the lost world of antiquity has simply been drowned into another kind of world. It has never ceased. It has simply been submerged. As man developed, his external propensities and powers, his psychic and mystical propensities, retired more and more deeply into himself. They apparently were lost, like a lost continent. The soul was lost in the body, but the soul did not die. It remained hidden beneath the surface of things. Truth was lost in error, but truth did not die. It is merely concealed by the veil of error drawn across its face, or at least it is drowned in a water of illusion, but it lies like the ancient city beneath the surface of the ocean, that men could look down and see the roofs. So in Pike's thinking, the great order of the wise never actually ceased. It never became any different from what it was. It couldn't, because the wise themselves could never be felt foolish or never become so. That which possesses truth, truly and actually, can never lose it. Therefore, behind and below the surface of things stands forever the strange figure of the totally illumined mediator, the God-man, the man-God, the ancient ones of the earth, those who knew, can never have ceased to know. The great philosophies and principles which they taught can never have ceased to be themselves. But over the surface of them has been drawn this strange tracing of error, until we can no longer see them. And we have even taken their lives and their teachings and deformed them. But though we deform them 1,000 times, we can never change one whit of their substance. It remains forever. But man, having by his own ways divided himself from these great shadowy forms, we have another series of legends which bear upon this, of ancient teachers that returned to the sky, of sages that walked off into the mysterious cities of the north, a Lao Tzu on his green water ox going off into Gobi to the land of the sages to wait. Always apparently, these sages retire. They go back. They promise, however, always that they will return. Always the Great One will come back when the time is right, when those who are ready call him back. When the virtues fail upon the earth, he will come forth again. Always the promise that the mediator is not dead but sleepeth, and will return and restore the beauties and perfections of his faith if his people keep the faith. We have the same thing in the Adventism of Christianity, the second coming of Christ. The idea that the Great One will return. But always your truth symbol keeps the covenant by a second coming, which seems to imply, beyond all doubt, a first appearance. And the restoration of truth, as a term, means the restoring of that which has already been, not that which has never existed. So Pike tells us in his thinking that beneath the surface, the great association of the light still functions. And he believed that at some remote period, maybe 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, the first revelations of this ancient body that we know of, the first revelations flowed into Persia and flowed into the Indo-Gangetic plain, and that therefore that the two great structures, the Avestas and the Vedas, constitute perhaps the earliest and most total revelation of this thing that all men are still seeking. He was convinced that then the streams continued to flow, flowing into many directions, and that in all these flowings there was a root in reality, but that as the streams flowed forth, mixed and mingled, passed over various types of earth and gathered impurities, their currents became abrupted and broken, rapids came, the waters were muddy and defiled, and in the end, men used these streams merely to till their fields rather than to redeem their souls, and that the great stream of this faith gradually disappeared into the earth like water after rain, until man can no longer find it, and that in the place of it he has a great group of secondary institutions built upon the ethical phases of the ancient faith, but without the keys to its ancient doctrine. In discussing the subject of the Zoroastrian fire principle, Pike also comes to certain conclusions that he regards as very important. He tells us, deriving much of his thinking from his own acquaintance with transcendental magic, he tells us that fire is not only a symbol of deity, not only a symbol of purification, not only a symbol of light, not only an emblem of the sun. It is more than any and all of this. Fire is the symbol of the great chemical agent. Fire is the symbol of the power that works the great alchemical regeneration. Fire is actually, therefore, the tremendous agent, the master builder. Fire is represented in some legendary in the heroic figure of Tubal-Cain, the ironmonger, the man who is able to pound the swords into plowshares. Fire is the temperer of iron, and by means of it, iron is hardened into steel, and from this steel is fashioned the sword Notong, the sword of the Volsungen. It is also the sword Excalibur, the mysterious sacred emblem of the Arthurian cycle. And it is finally that sword of quick detachment, by means of which we are able to take the snaky branches of the banyan tree and cut them off, freeing ourselves from illusion. And it is also the sword of Damocles, hanging over the banquet of Dionysus of Syracuse, the sword suspended by a single hair, which can fall and destroy man. It is the two-edged sword coming out of the mouth of the great figure of Revelation. It is the sword, the golden blazing sword of the cherubs guarding the gates of Eden. This sword is a flame. This flame is itself a symbol of the great art, the tremendous science, by means of which all things passing through the fire are made new. There is a strange meaning. This fire is also the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This fire, which burns forever upon the altar of the human being, is the fire of life, the fire in the blood, the fire in the heart, which is truly the altar, the living altar of the soul. But this fire, to Pike, was a symbol by means of which he was convinced that the signatura rerum, the seal, the true signature of the great order, which lay at the root of things, was stamped upon the ancient peoples who worshipped it, knowing why they worshipped, knowing the mystery of fire, knowing, as the ancient Rosicrucians knew, how to make fire burn in water, and how to make water feed fire as a fuel. That behind all of this was the statement of the science that later came into existence in alchemy, in Hermetic philosophy, in Kabbalism, in Buddhism, in the Vedanta, in the yogic doctrines of Patanjali. The fire, this mysterious power, which if it be lifted up and subjected to the rules of science, will draw all things unto it. Therefore, that by the fire was now meant the operative mystery of truth. That while many things are speculative, the fire by its own virtue and its own symbol becomes the difference between the fire of truth and the coal light of intellect. That it becomes the power of the universe made available to man so that he may see in the night of his own ignorance. This fire man did not invent. He merely released it. The wisdom of the great ones of the earth, man does not create. He releases it. It comes to his knowing because it is always present and becomes either the consumer of him or the enlightener of him. The great art, then, is that this fire must burn away the dross, that this fire must temper the weak metal, that this fire must be fed upon body until it becomes master of body, consuming all things that are not itself. This is then the mysterious fire of the Samadhi and the Nirvana of Buddhism. It is the symbol of the great art. It is a symbol of the science of human perfection. Pike gives us innumerable references to this and builds much of his symbolism upon the conviction that this is the basis. That without the true knowledge of the fire, man labors in vain. And that this fire, therefore, belongs peculiarly and wonderfully to the central core mystery of being. That man began as the spark from the flame. That man actually first raised his altars to the fire. And whether he outwardly and intellectually knew it or not, he was stating the nearest thing to absolute truth that he was able to conceive at that time. And ever since then, he has been taking something away from it. He has never added to it, because he chose in the beginning perhaps the truest symbol that he could possibly have devised. Therefore, says Pike, we now have not simply a central geographical region surrounded by a group of peoples. We have a central psychographical quality represented now by the ever-burning fire. The fire which, according to legend, has never failed, even though historically perhaps it has. But this fire is now surrounded by a series of other fires that have been lighted by its torch. And wherever this fire springs up, it seems to tell us that the one torch lit it. And this circumference of fires, gradually spreading on and on, like the mysterious campfires in the sky of the ancient Sioux warrior waiting for death, these fires going on have created roads or paths, because the way they traveled becomes a road for anyone who wishes to travel back. Consequently, in all parts of the world, there is pilgrimage. Pilgrimage back to the father fountains, back to the parent fire. And around the fire is a wall, a great structure to protect the holy place, like the strange walls around the tabernacle in the wilderness. Walls have been built to guard the sanctuary, that the profane may not enter. And these walls, in Pike's thinking, are the walls of faith. That they are not actually enemies of the fire. They are guardians. They stand almost like armed cherubs, guarding the 12 gates to the holy land of truth. And these cherubs with flaming swords will not permit the uninitiated to enter into the sacred ground. Therefore, these religions have gradually become systems of discipline. They have become ways of purification. They have become the pronaos of the temple, the outer part, the porch. And no one can enter the sanctuary who does not first pass through the porch to be challenged by the guardians like those who entered the ancient Egyptian mysteries. And unless they have the right word, unless they are able to prove their fitness to go on, the door does not open, and they remain outside. Only those who are permitted to pass these gates have right of entry. Pike points out in 1878 that it's a little a pity that religions have not recognized this very significant point, that they, like the flaming cherubs, are the guardians of something superior to them all. And that therefore, this idle controversy as to which one is the holiest among them is one of the worst wastes of time in history, and furthermore, the greatest cause of cruelty perhaps the world has ever known. That in attempting to vie with each other, they have forgotten that they were created to stand guard. They were created as gates, leading not to themselves, but through themselves, to that which was the substance of them all. That discovering this substance, that man was then, perhaps more than ever before, capable of being grateful to the paths that he had walked. One of the Eastern teachers once said that any good disciple can outgrow his master, but that he can never outgrow the gratitude that he owes his master. And those that teach us along the way, the great gates through which we pass, we may pass through them. But if each of these sanctuaries has been a good and faithful servant of the Eternal, we shall ever be grateful that it stands. And though we may pass into other things, we shall still defend it with a whole heart and feel the nobility and significance of the purpose which it serves. If, however, we accept each of these gates as the substance rather than the shadow of the substance, and become hopelessly involved in each as a separate thing, the great blazing altar of the real goes unattended. A man has not achieved the great identity of his own spiritual aspiration. So these gates become the natural doors, the mysterious 12 gates in the city of the New Jerusalem. And through these gates men can move. But these gates are each of them marked with tests, with trials, with obligations. And these obligations are not, as we have been told or have been taught to think, that they are not the arbitrary dictates of a deity who tells us that we must go hungry when we want to eat, or that we must be miserable in order to be virtuous. That is not the concept at all. These trials exist for only one purpose, namely that they represent the undergraduate work in the University of Truth. We have to face them as such. The trial is given to us not because we are sinners or we are born in sin and conceived in iniquity. The trial is given to us because we are truth seekers. And in order to achieve the truth we seek, we must become the truth we seek. Therefore, these tests, these trials, these disciplines are absolutely indispensable to those who would approach the flame. For if those who approach the flame are not so disciplined, so that the dross in their own natures has not been voluntarily removed, then they approach the flame with combustible material and will find not the light of ages, but a consuming fire, because the dross cannot survive the flame. Therefore, it is the duty of man to remove the dross. cross before he approaches the flame. If not, the experience is painful rather than helpful. So ethics represents merely the outer shadow, the exoteric name for discipline. Men do not do these things for the benefit of each other. They do not do these things primarily, actually, for the benefit of themselves as persons. They do these things in the name of and in the cause of the truth, without which they cannot live or survive. So Pike points out that in his estimation, that circle of ancient guardians actually existed. And by degrees, through the passing of time, we have forgotten that they were indeed a circle guarding a sacred place. And because that thing which was in the center of that place was not a vast cathedral built by men, was not a wonderful holy city leaving 10 layers of ruin for us to excavate, but because that thing in the center was mostly life, pure life, it was easy to forget it, because we couldn't see anything with our objective senses. We could not sense the magnitude unless we achieved it. Thus the center gradually ceased to exist as far as we are concerned. Our own ignorance caused us to miss the implication entirely. And we began to make each of these gates centers in themselves. And we had many centers, therefore many faiths, rather than many gates to one. Then, of course, followed the general confusion of tongues, confusion of minds, and confusion of souls, and it became possible for men to kill each other in the name of God. It became possible for them to persecute each other in the name of truth, because the center was gone. And without that center, each thing standing by itself alone was inadequate, unreal, imperfect. The loss of the consciousness of the center made it possible for us to be fanatics, made it possible for us to be bigots, whereas the realization of that center would have preserved the great and magnificent geometrical harmony of the divine plan. Having missed the point, we did not, however, miss it without some redeeming factors had we realized it, because these gates were originally created with the correct purpose. Pike is convinced that they were. And he is also convinced that these gates, when in the course of ages a faith failed or a religion ceased, and therefore a gate was left untended, that immediately out of the structure of the general pattern new gatekeepers came, who were also to remain the custodians of these gates. Therefore, all religions were not founded at exactly the same time as separate sects. They might be founded over a period of 20,000 years. Yet still, actually, they are those gates. And the gate factor itself never changes. Having recognized that all existing faiths were either founded upon the original plan or founded by branching from those who were part of the original plan, that a strange, semi-lost continuity has continued, and that the old mystery temples, which flourished as late in the Near East and in the Mediterranean areas as the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries of the Christian era, that these mystery temples were aware, at least in part, of their kinship with the ancient roots. Furthermore, these older temples did keep a certain roadway open between themselves. And from the travels of Pythagoras, and later of Apollonius Tyanus, and other of the great initiates of the period, we know that these persons traveled from one of these great centers to another with adequate passports. that they traveled as persons known and expected. When Apollonius reached the northern parts of the Ganges River, the headwaters of the Ganges, he found there the Indian teachers waiting for him, already aware that he was coming. Now, some may say, perhaps they were just clairvoyant. Perhaps they were, but it was at least one point. He came not as a stranger, but as one expected and awaited, and one welcomed. In those days, this relationship between these groups was not hopelessly lost. They had not become creed-bound. They had not said, my God against thy God. Or they already had achieved and had maintained, as Pythagoras tells us, the realization that in all the various areas that he visited, and he visited over 20 of the great religious systems of Europe, the Near East, the Far East, and North Africa, that they all taught the same doctrine and they all knew it. And that was as late as 550 BC. They knew it. And yet, in these intervening 2400 years, this knowledge has been generally lost. So we have an interesting evidence that knowledge has gotten lost even after history has been able to record it. Pike is therefore convinced, and I think he has a very strong story in his behalf, that this knowledge of being waves leading in to this great central fire core, this knowledge existed, probably generally known, as late as Plato and Socrates, perhaps a little later. Less generally, but somewhat widely known, as late as the 6th century A.D. Still known in some areas to the present time, but comparatively unknown to what we call Western culture. That this factor is known in Asia and in North Africa, I have reason to believe. I discussed some of these problems with some very learned Copts in Cairo, and they assured me that these facts were fully known to them. But these peripheral groups, almost untouched by the rapid so-called progress of the Western way of life, these are not listened to anymore, any more than are a few of the learned Sufis and dervishes who also know, nor certain of the very learned Taoists and Zen monks who also know. These things are not totally unknown. They are totally ignored by the majority of Western peoples. But the concept leads into the next important point, and that is that from the ancient mysteries, we have by natural heritage, as Pike points out, in incorporating part of this ritualism and symbolism into the Scottish degrees of Freemasonry, Pike points out that into this modern knowledge, and we can read it in Iamblichus on the Mysteries, in Proclus on the Theology of Plato, in the Eleusinian and Bacchic Mysteries, the Mysteries of Mithras, and many others, that these rituals are what we might term the gates, are still known. That there is this gate, a doctrine of awareness, the Zen concept of the mystery of the gateless gate. That this gate knowledge is still available. And Pike points out that it will always remain the same. In one generation it may be forgotten and another remembered. Perhaps sometime Vishnu must be born again to bring the law out of the depths of the ocean, where it had been stolen away by giants. But regardless of what happens to the law remains. And man must come finally to the old road that leads to the law. And these ancient institutions, the mysteries, gradually bestowed part of their insight, but only a part, upon the rising theological systems that succeeded them in most areas. But each time this transmission was made, something was obscured by a heavier layer of symbols, until it became less and less easy to see the facts. But Pike points out that once you possess the key, not necessarily the great key that unlocks all truths, but now merely the point of view, which is the key, the discrimination to recognize landmarks, as some of the Freemasonic brethren call them, if we can see and recognize the landmarks, we will recognize the fact that no faith has ever been without them. We can also recognize that in every generation, in every religion, a few have recognized them and have quietly gone into this quiet search along the mysterious thread of Ariadne that led out of the labyrinth of confusion into the broad light of common sense. Out of all this consideration, then, Pike tells us, the essential remains. The mysteries, as we knew them then, have mostly fallen ruin in time. They have, however, bestowed themselves as moral forces and as intangible but real values upon those things that succeeded them. And these, in turn, have, in one way or another, perpetuated, often without knowing it, certain peculiar doctrines, certain particular arrangement of emblems and patterns, whether in music, in art, in literature, or architecture, or scripture, science, philosophy, religion. These different groups have all perpetuated the key. The only problem is to find it, to get it out again. And the key, there's always the road that leads to the gate. And at the gate, through the mystery of initiation, supplies the pass sign, by means of which the individual can pass into the ancient temple, where he can come finally into the sanctum sanctorum, or the adytum of the house, the great central place in which stands alone the flaming symbol of the eternal. Thus, the search is for this. And Pike, being a scholar in these things and a great researcher, realizes that the secret societies of the ancients were therefore the elementary schools, so to say, leading into this knowledge. That their primary purpose was to give man the moral and ethical indoctrination by which he became capable of discriminating value, by means of which he could finally say with Omar, referring to the mysterious dances of the dervishes, Omar says, "From my base metal shall be filed the key that shall unlock the door they howl without." And that is the problem. The purpose of these systems of religion, extended from the mystery systems, is to proceed to the regeneration of man within certain limits, the gradual restoration of the good word, the good deed, and the good thought, the gradual beginning of the purification of the individual, by which, through the cultivation of the upright life, through the actual practice of self-control and self-discipline, through the application of proper principles to every action of conduct, the individual gradually gains the first thing that he needs, namely, the power to govern himself. The power to dedicate himself, the power to place value above profit in everything, the power to choose self-sacrifice before the proclamation of truth, the power gradually to make the recognition of the value of reality strong enough to impel the person to go forward to the attainment of that which he has discovered. It is not from hope of heaven or from fear of hell that man must develop virtue. He must develop it because without it, he cannot sufficiently regenerate his own organism so that he is capable of the great mystery ritual of truth seeking. Pike therefore points out that having passed through a certain tempering in the lesser fires, the spirit is strengthened, the resolution is strengthened, the individual gains gradual control of the mind and the emotions and the body, until finally, through self-discipline, he is capable of attaining that internal integration, which is peace, which is security in the true sense of the word. And that as one in peace with all things, including himself, in total peace with the world and with life and with reality, the individual, thus completely at peace, may pass through into the mysterious room beyond to find himself in the mysterious sanctuary of the ancient ones of the earth. He will then realize that he indeed has walked the path that all those who were truth-seeking, wise and good before him, have also walked. That he is walking the path of light. That he is therefore entering into the true religion. That he is seeking the everlasting fire and is finding it. And is satisfied to become the servant of that flame. And in so doing, he attains not to knowledge in the common sense. He attains rather to identity with primordial knowing. He participates in the fact of truth, as did ancient man before ignorance, sin, and death came into his world. And because man has overcome ignorance, sin, and death in himself, he then becomes also one of those ancient ones who is timeless, who belongs to the order of the mediators, and becomes truly educated, truly enlightened, truly wise. This is the only wisdom there is. There is no other. And all the search for worldly wisdom leads in the end either to total disillusionment or else total dedication to that which is true. This was General Pike's central concept, and it seems to me that it is a valuable one, and I think for those of you who belong to the Masonic Order, it will have certain also special meanings. And so we thank you very much and hope